back to the Zero to Hero podcast. I am your host, Danny Duma, producer Carl. How's it going, buddy?
Good, how are you?
There's a lot of pregame talk about your beard. It seems to be like a regular occurrence on the show now. At some point, I think there's going to have to be a podcast of just you and me talking about beards.
Just combing to the camera.
I think the reach could be pretty big for that one.
Might just be 50% though, because women don't. I mean, some women grow beards, but not all women.
Or again, I just learned about this ASMR thing. Maybe there should be a beard combing ASMR sound.
For sure.
It would be soothing.
I think you need to condition your hair if that's what that sounds like.
I think we're onto something here. Moving forward.
Good start, guys. Good start.
Really excited about today's guest. I know I've been posting a ton on social media about her. We met for a coffee a couple days ago, and I didn't really know what to expect by the coffee meeting, but I was very pleasantly surprised. I left with this feeling of, is this a word? Yes, that one. Good thing she's here, Carl.
We'll help each other
I love this
out.
Feeling of admiration because I had no idea what to expect, but it was very cool to see how self-aware and open you are. And
you.
Looking forward to diving a little deeper into the world of mental health / mental illness
today. Sounds good. Awesome.
Megan Cereda, how are you?
I'm good. I'm a little anxious, to be honest, but that's what life is, so let's do it.
100%. So am I, to be honest.
Cool.
You're an avid listener of the Zero to Hero podcast.
I am. I'm a big fan.
So you know that I start every show asking,
what
am I going to ask you?
The three words or short phrases that describe me. Do you know how many times I've changed these words?
Oh, you say you've planned.
Yes. So I'm going to say empathetic.
Okay.
To a fault.
I like the word empathetic. Okay.
And then my next one will be vulnerable.
Okay.
And last I'll say intense.
Okay.
So feeling good and bad things intensely.
I think those are three traits that I would like to think that I have. I'd like to think I'm pretty empathetic. I am often very, very intense. And I think I learned that through sport, but now it kind of translates into business, and I describe myself, maybe intensity is not the exact word, but I describe myself as like almost obsessive.
Mm-hmm.
When
I said that, yeah.
I'm really excited about something, I'm like over the top, all in on it.
Yeah.
Whether it's hiking in the summer or real estate business wise or now podcast world.
There you go. And I think that contributes to your success for sure.
What was the middle word?
It was vulnerable.
I think that's what we're going to get into tonight, aren't we?
Cool. Yeah. I mean, I'm an open book, so let's do it.
I like it.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe just for... This is something that we talked about at the coffee meeting the other day. The difference between mental health and mental illness.
Yeah.
And just kind of chat quickly about that.
Let's do it. So 1 in 5 Canadians this year will experience a mental illness. 5 in 5 Canadians will experience mental health. So mental health isn't necessarily positive or negative. Everyone has it. It's how you deal with it. Mental illness is a little bit different. It's usually a diagnosis, not necessarily, and usually come in episodes, but can last on and off throughout your whole life, unfortunately. But yeah.
Okay. I was doing a little bit of Googling this afternoon, and Google defines mental illness as an illness that affects the way people think, feel, behave, and interact with others.
Mm-hmm.
Is that accurate?
For sure. Yeah. With dialectical behavioral therapy, which is one of the treatments I've tried and is really good for anxiety and depression, they talk about the relationship between our behavior, our thoughts, and our feelings. So everything we do affects how we feel, and it just is a big triangle and kind of goes in and out like a ripple in a pond. So everything you think and makes you act a certain way, makes you feel a certain way. So if you can change one aspect of that triangle, it changes the other two aspects as well. So if you're able to change your thinking or your feelings, your behavior and thinking can change as well.
Okay. Before we kind of get into your story, I wanted to just throw a little disclaimer out there.
Go for it.
This is not an area of expertise for me. I am very excited to learn more about the world of mental health and mental illness. Mm-hmm. And I know I've said things on other podcasts that maybe come across as ignorant. And maybe some of the questions or some of the things I say tonight may come off as naive and uneducated, but it's just know that it's for the purpose of me wanting to understand more. And it's because I have a big curiosity in it. Mm-hmm. I've said the words, I just don't understand a lot in when talking about mindset and different ways that people overcome adversity and negativity. And I maybe need to provide a little bit more context when I'm talking about that kind of stuff, but it's not that I don't understand or have empathy for what other people are going through or how they handle stress different ways. It's more just the way that I'm wired and the way that I was brought up. And from my experiences,
for sure,
it's difficult for me to put myself in that situation and react the same way that someone else is. Yeah. So it's more just tonight, I want to chat about your experiences, but get more of an understanding of what goes through each individual's head that results in something completely different.
Yeah, for sure. And I think by owning that is such a huge step. I mean, I live with mental illness as well as had some experience on the professional side, and I'm not an expert either. What I'm going to be talking about is 100% only from my experience. I would hate to speak for anyone else because everyone's journey with mental illness and with mental health is completely different. What works for some people doesn't work for other people. I'm just going to share what I've lived through and what works for me, and that's all I can really do.
It's become more and more of a topic in society now to understand mental health and mental illness is a big deal. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly where I'm going with this, but I'm excited to bring a little bit more insight into the world. And I think it's important to note that don't judge people. Like, one thing I always talk about is like gaining context. So most people have no context on what is going on behind closed doors in someone else's life.
Exactly.
You're seeing a surface reaction. Mm-hmm. You have no idea what's happened in the last month, year, 10 years of their life that has brought out that reaction. So I like that we started the podcast with the word empathy, empathetic, because I think that's something important to keep in mind.
For sure.
Especially, or if you're seeing signs in friends of a potential mental illness, rather than being conscious about the way that you're reacting to those things that you're seeing.
And I think it goes both ways, like being empathetic and compassionate to someone who may be experiencing it, but also empathetic and compassionate to yourself if you are experiencing it. Mm-hmm. There is so much stigma out there, even still, which is very unfortunate, especially with such a large population having lived through it or knowing someone who's living through it. So it's a little disheartening, but just to remember that it's totally normal and there's nothing wrong with it. People don't experience stigma for cancer or for wearing glasses. And it's exactly the same thing, right? It's nothing that anyone's done wrong. It's unfortunately you've picked the short straw or experienced some trauma, and it's just how life goes.
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe let's start with a little bit of your story.
Cool, cool.
So kind of, I guess, when your kind of journey in the mental illness world started.
Okay, so I think my first diagnosis was generalized anxiety disorder, and I think I was 16. That being said, when I was in grade 2, they were concerned about some heart problems, and I had a heart monitor on, and it turns out it was anxiety. So even from such a young age, I was an anxious kid. Again, nothing wrong with that. It's created the person that I am, and I love that. I have been volunteering the majority of my life as well. My father is a firefighter, shouts out. But he's taught me to give back, and we're so privileged in Canada, and I grew up from a privileged family. So it's just important for me to be giving back as well. So that started my journey with my professional side of it. I have my degree in child and youth care counseling. So I've worked in residential homes with people living with mental illness, living with addictions, living with trauma, living with history of abuse. But then on the same side, I have dealt with all of those things. And I thought that most of it was kind of behind me, and I thought that I was doing really well. And I went abroad for 3 months to Zambia as a volunteer trip as well. And I like to call it like the best time of my life, but also the worst time of my life. It was such an amazing learning experience to be out of Canada, to be giving back in a third world country, living within the community and not kind of tucked away. That being said, we experienced a lot of trauma while we were there. A lot of sexual harassment, a lot of racism. And those are things that I didn't know, but were also very triggering for me as well. So coming back from that, I struggled a lot with anxiety and depression, and I couldn't really figure it out. And through some other doctors and some different psychiatrists, I was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. So, I mean, I have a few diagnoses and they're labels and they help me get funding and they help me with meds, but that's not like who I am. But with the borderline, it's very much trauma. So the way that it was described to me is like the perfect storm. So not only have I experienced this trauma, but also my brain is predisposed to handle that trauma in a certain way. Mm-hmm. So someone that was beside me in that Zambia situation and experienced all the same trauma as me, but had a different brain wiring, may not have responded at all the same way that I did. Mm-hmm. So yeah, after that, I worked a little bit longer in my field and I couldn't do it anymore. It wasn't fair to myself. It wasn't fair to the clients because I wasn't 100% there. I wasn't giving them all that I wanted to give them. So I've taken some time for myself, and I'm beyond blessed that I have a family that support me. So I know that that's not everyone's story, but I'm super grateful for that.
Can we go back to when?
Yeah.
When you were a kid, you said you were very anxious. Mm-hmm. You had a lot of anxiety. I think back to when I was a kid, and I felt like I had a lot of anxiety as well. Like sports made me very anxious mm-hmm. and nervous. I just felt like I maybe coped with it well, but like what types of things on a day-to-day basis made you anxious?
As a kid?
Yeah.
They're pretty similar to the same now. Yeah. People pleasing is huge.
Yeah.
I care so much what people think to a detriment, mm-hmm. Which I think is like the opposite of what you feel, which is awesome. I wish I could care less, but yeah, so worrying about what other people think, my definition of what failure looks like, I wanted to avoid that. Again, you learn from your failures, which is amazing and such a strength of your character. But my brain, again, didn't work like that, unfortunately. But yeah, it was very much ensuring that everyone around me was happy, kind of being the jokester and making sure that everyone was smiling no matter what was going on.
How, I guess, how would you handle anxiety?
Back then or now?
Both.
I don't think I dealt with it back then. I don't think that it was really known what it was. Like, even when that heart monitor test came back with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then just in hindsight, I realized, well, those are all the same symptoms that I experience now when I experience anxiety. So it was the same thing back then. Sorry, what was the question? What do I feel?
Or like
physically?
How do you handle it? How do you react when you're in an anxious situation?
Yeah, so it's different. It depends on what the trigger is. Sometimes okay. I isolate. Sometimes I mask and become way over the top and kind of joke and loud and like be like that, kind of like clown around. And that's a way of like hiding the way I'm actually feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I have anxiety attacks and I don't have any control over those, but that's my body's response. I've learned a lot of amazing tools throughout my different types of therapy. So ideally, I would like to utilize those in those anxious situations. So meditating or having a bath or coloring or listening to my five senses all kind of regrounds me in those situations. Or cranking a song while I'm driving does the same kind of thing.
One of the things I was going to ask you about mm-hmm. was mechanisms to bring yourself down, I guess, after an anxiety attack. And so, like, I had a list of things like, does music help? Does fitness help? Does what, watching TV? I don't know. Does like shutting everything out and being in complete silence?
It's different for everyone.
Yeah.
So there's new research in regards to what an introvert and an extrovert is. It used to be thought of as like how you interacted with the world. And I used to consider myself an extrovert because I love to hang out with people. I love to joke around. I like to be surrounded by people. But the new research is how you refill your cup. So in that sense, I'm an introvert because I would prefer to be alone in the bathtub or reading or quietly watching a Netflix show. So that's how I refill my cup. After an anxiety attack, there's no need to bring myself down because I'm utterly exhausted. An anxiety attack takes everything out of me, physically and mentally. So it's usually how to bring myself back up after that.
Okay.
So music is really, really good because it can alter your mood both ways. It can make you happier. It can make you sad. It can make you angry, whatever, depending on the song you pick, of course. Fitness is really good. I use it as preventative. And it sounds like you use it as self-care as well, which is so cool. I wish I utilized it more, but it's hard some days with the depression to actually get up and be active. So I try and do it as much as possible. Having a puppy definitely helps. Even on my bad depression days, she sits there and she gives me those looks, and it's easier to do it for someone else or for her than it is to do it for myself. But yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the other day that there's a few big events in your past that had, and you use the analogy of like starting cuts.
Mm-hmm.
And then you went to Zambia for these 3 months and some situations that you found yourself in kind of dug those deeper.
Yeah.
Do you want to just like explain that a little bit?
So I'm just going to clarify just because we spoke about it.
Yeah.
But those cuts that you're referring to are cuts on the brain. So when you think about trauma, think of it like every traumatic event. So we talked about big traumas and little traumas. Little trauma is being bullied or falling downstairs and everyone laughing at you, or a breakup. Whereas a big trauma is a head-on collision or your parents divorcing or you divorcing, sexual assault, physical assault, ongoing abuse in a relationship, right? So with the brain, depending on if it's a big trauma or a little trauma, the cut will be corresponding to that. So with those traumas on your brain, unlike the rest of the world where all time heals all wounds, it's not like that with your brain. So these little cuts get put onto your brain, and if they're re-triggered or you experience something similar, those cuts get deeper and deeper. So until those cuts are resolved, they don't go away. So if I had a past of like a sexual trauma, being sexually harassed in Zambia would recreate those cuts and deepen those cuts.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want me to go into specifics about my traumas?
No, not that you have to, but that was pretty good. You mentioned, I don't know, I talk a lot about insecurities, and for me, I often look at things that bugged me in the past, and through experience, I guess I've just been able to get over them. Like I wasn't always in a position where I didn't care at all what people thought about me. As a kid, I got embarrassed really easily. So to me, that means I'm caring what other people think.
For sure, yeah.
But through, I guess, just seeing that whatever other people said about me or did to me, it doesn't affect me at all. In terms of like a long-term outcome, if somebody says, oh, you can't do that, I can do it if I want to.
Yeah.
It's really up to me. So it was more just figuring out as a young adult that nothing anyone says or can do around me is going to affect where I want to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You've talked about like your failures being a learning experience, mm-hmm. which is, I think, the exception to the rule. Maybe that's just coming from my perspective and kind of the way my brain works. But taking those experiences and learning from them is definitely a form of self-care, I think. And you said that I was very self-aware. I think that knowing that you can grow from it is also being self-aware. That being said, I feel like I grow from my mental illness. I feel like it has made me more vulnerable and made me more empathetic. So there are strengths that come from it. It's just the looking at the failures and what people think of me, I haven't gotten over. So I wonder if with you, because you were in sports growing up, I mean, so was I, but you were at a more competitive level, if that's where you gained like your self-confidence and then no one could really kind of shake that after it was solidified.
It definitely helped with confidence. In terms of getting over failures, I think I just lost so much that it became normal.
Oh, that sucks.
It is what it is, though.
Yeah, for sure.
Especially in sports, like, take the NFL. There's 32 teams in the league. One team wins every year. Everyone else is a loser.
But
that's the way I look at it.
Okay. I'm going to challenge that thought.
Again, this is my
No. Mindset. Yeah, for sure.
So as a kid, I'm never winning anything because there's only one winner. And I always end up losing. Let's say our basketball team goes 25-2 throughout the year, but you lose in the final, you lost. You're a loser. So you learn to cope with losing, or at least I did, I think, through sport. And that motivated me because it pissed me off so much.
Where does your definition of losing come from? Because if you had a 24-2 season, that's a hell of a season. Why does that make you a loser? Just because you weren't able to get it right at the end.
Because you didn't win.
But you won 24 games.
I know, but you lost.
You're looking at the big picture instead of the journey, right?
I was a pretty emotional kid.
Well, that's what I think Mandy and Danielle were both saying. It's not about that final destination. It's the journey. So with that journey of 24-2, that's where you find your happiness versus the actual championship.
I think I look at it even bigger than that, though.
Oh.
And say, this is a big loss. Those 24 wins. Mm-hmm. I know this is like super specific to like a sport or team sport or whatever.
No.
But those 24 wins are so small in the big scheme of life. Whereas that big loss, for example, one game I remember extremely well is in U17, I was on the provincial basketball team. We lost in the final to Ontario by 2. We beat them earlier in the tournament by 20.
Yeah, you talked about
this. So that early 20-point win means absolutely nothing. The 2-point loss is a big deal. And so those, like, I don't really remember anything about that 20-point win, and I probably had my best game of the tournament.
Yeah.
I think I, like, had 20-plus points, held their best player to, like, 2. But, like, I remember specific plays from the final and, like, specific shots that I took and missed.
Of course, missed.
So, I don't know. I look back on that and I can remember how painful it was as a 17-year-old to lose that game.
And that's because of the way our brains are built to work. So you have different parts of your brain. You have the amygdala, which is like your old brain is what they call it. So it's like your fight, flight, or freeze. And then you have your cortex, which is like your emotions, your impulse control, your consequences, stuff like that. Only one part of the brain can work at a time. So it's either the amygdala or the cortex. That being said, The amygdala forces us to remember negative things. I think it's somewhere between 6 and 9 times more often as a positive thing. So for every negative memory, just to balance it out, or negative self-talk, just to balance it out, you need to have upwards of 9 positive thoughts just to balance it out. So your brain is wired to remember the negative things as a self-preservation, because these berries are going to kill me, or that mammoth chasing me is going to kill me, versus, oh, that flower I can eat and turn into tea. Well, that's great, but it's not as important to remember as the berries that kill you, right?
Yeah.
So it's really just the way our brains, unfortunately, are wired. And we don't really need that fight, flight, or freeze anymore, because society has completely changed. We don't need to hunt. We don't need to run away. I mean, unless you're hiking, you don't need to run away from a lot of animals. but yeah.
I think it, maybe the way I explain it comes off as a negative, saying that I remember the failures and talking about the failure all the time. But I look at it in this big picture, and to me in the big picture, it's very optimistic. And this is the way that I think about it, is that remembering the feeling and exactly what happened that day, if we're talking about this game specifically, has pushed me and motivated me so much more than if I won that game.
Just to avoid that feeling again?
Correct.
That makes sense, for sure.
So I look at it as a very positive experience.
Oh, yeah.
Going through it, of course, it sucks and is very painful.
And you talked about that experience in one of the other podcasts. And I just wanted to note that you talked about actually expressing your feelings, and you cried after that. You said cried for a couple of days.
It was.
And
I couldn't move too. So I was crying. I sprained my ankle really bad with 4 minutes left.
Oh.
And I couldn't walk for 2 weeks.
Oh.
So I was lying on the sofa sobbing in my parents' house.
Oh, no.
And they're like, get over it.
No. Don't get over it. That's absolutely amazing that as a young man, you were able to express your feelings, because in society now, our traditional gender norms say, no, be a man. Men don't cry. Well, of course they cry. Men still have feelings. They're allowed to express their feelings. They're allowed to be angry and sad and happy. Women don't need to be the only emotional ones, right? So if we're talking about mental health or mental illness, men, here, let me grab the actual statistic. Men are 3 times more likely to complete suicide over women. Men do not usually reach out and accept for help or ask for help, whereas women try and utilize it, right? And I think that comes from those stereotypes where men don't talk about their feelings. They don't talk with their buddies about it. They joke, they have beers, they have quote unquote locker room talk, whereas women sit around and talk about their feelings. So it's kind of a more normal thing. So when men aren't reaching out and asking for help, they're taking this on so much, not so much heavier, I don't want to compare, but they're taking it on more by themselves. Also with those suicide rates, their means of suicide is a more, I'm going to say dangerous method. So with men, they often choose to, or no, not going to use choose. They often die by hanging or by a gun, where women often reach for a razor or for pills. So it's a less permanent, or it can be less permanent than hanging or a gun.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you think, talking about men like you did, and maybe this is kind of playing along the same thing, but do you think they're hesitant to show emotion? Because I was never really, sports, I was very emotional in sports. And so maybe that's where I learned it from. But I was never afraid to really show it.
And I think you're an exception.
It's hard for me. Yeah, I'll accept that compliment.
Good,
Thank you.
You go.
But do you think men are scared to show emotion because of the historical norm that men need to be strong, provide, blah, blah, blah? Or do you think it's more down to the individual that it's an insecurity, that they don't want their buddies to see them crying and be called a wimp or whatever?
I'm going to say both, because where do those insecurities come from? Our society norms, right? So a man feels, and again, I'm not a man, I can't speak for how men feel in regards to mental illness, or feelings, but I would imagine that being told from a very young age that, oh, man up or chin up or boys don't cry or stop being a girl or other words that relate to body parts, but being told that and having it shoved down your throat, even in media, what you're seeing on social media, on TV growing up, right? That subconsciously seeps in and builds those insecurities. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that happens for both genders as well, right? Women and body image on magazines and in social media now, same thing. Mm-hmm. You're not distinctly being told, well, you're fat or you aren't good enough. But by comparing yourself to what is quote unquote normal or in the media, you have that comparison and you go, well, that's not what I'm like. So that creates that insecurity, right? The discrepancy between where you're at and what you're seeing other people being at.
Yeah, this is a good segue into like, where do people start if they are, I'm going to use the word depression. I don't know if it's the right word or not, but if they're feeling these types of things, if they're feeling depressed, if they're noticing their behaviors change, mm-hmm. where do you start?
There's so many different places you can start. First, you know yourself better than anybody else, right? So you know what's normal for you. You know what's abnormal from you. Being aware of your body. Usually these things come up in physical symptoms as well as mental. So stomach aches, headaches, things like that, right? But just to look out for other people as well as like, so talking to your GP, if you have a good relationship with them, or contacting some crisis lines. There's some that you can phone and speak to on the phone. There's others that you can text with if you're not comfortable with actually talking on the phone. There's great resources online that you can link up with. Just by Googling, like Bell Let's Talk is a really good one. And the Better Now workshop as well. But I think the biggest thing is just talk to anyone, right? Like if there's someone that you trust or you love or you know will be supportive, talk to them. Because you are not alone. Though it may feel like you're completely alone and that nobody loves you, there are people out there. And you just need to be reminded of that. Your GP can give you a referral. So that's really beneficial for moving forward. You can get a referral to addictions counseling or mental health counseling. You can get on a wait list so that counseling is subsidized, because that's a huge barrier in the mental health community is the cost. Granted, so are the wait lists, but it helps when it's funded a little bit. Another thing is if you're scared of what you might do, take yourself to the hospital. There are people that are trained to help you. You don't need to do this by yourself. You're not expected to do this by yourself. Like I said, no one is an expert, but reaching out to people who do this all day, every day is super helpful. It also reminds you that no matter how, are we allowed to swear? No matter how fucked up you think you are, there are so many other people out there that are struggling as well. And your doctor or your counselor or your psychiatrist or whatever can remind you of that. And they can say, yeah, what you're experiencing really, really sucks, but it's not the worst thing in the world either. And that there's other people that are experiencing the same thing and that you are not alone.
Talking for me, mm-hmm. I'm just knowing from my experience, but I assume other people can be very exhausting, especially when you're going in depth about maybe past traumas that you've gone through or whatever it may be, where you're feeling. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk a little bit about what you told me with only having a certain, the Spoonie theory.
Okay. Yeah. It's my favorite theory. It's a theory for mental illness as well as like chronic illness or chronic pain. So the reason it's called a Spoonie theory is because the person who created the theory was at a restaurant and what she had in front of her to do a physical show to her father was the spoons that were on the table. So for this, I'll use money because I think a lot of your listeners are entrepreneurs and that'll just relate better to them. So say that everybody has $100 to get through their day. For someone who is healthy, brushing your teeth, having a shower might be a dollar, might be $0. Going for a run or a hike might take up a couple dollars, right? So you to get through the day, you have $100. I have the same $100, but things might cost me a little bit more. So that shower might cost me $20 if it's a bad day. Going for a run might cost me $75, and it's just not worth it on that day. Coming here, $50. It's a good day, so maybe 50. But if you go over your $100, you're utilizing tomorrow's money. So if I'm withdrawing too much, then tomorrow I'm going to be fighting it as well. So a lot of the time, taking that into consideration, so like for today, knowing I had this tonight and I needed to save a lot of my money for the conversation, I had a really relaxing day. I did a lot of self-care. I had a bath, did a face mask, did all these things to add a little bit of money to my bank to ensure that I made it through this and wasn't completely depleted at the end of it. Yeah.
It's like, I went home afterwards and I actually went for a hike afterwards. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about that because I've never ever comprehended that before in terms of like looking at my day as a whole, mm-hmm. and saying, okay, this took, if I have 100% of energy, mm-hmm. in a day, this took out 5%, this took out 20%.
Yeah.
I've never thought about it that way. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to go back and see, okay, things actually do exhaust me.
Of course, yeah.
They take out more.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to look at it as a whole rather than just like, for me, these are all the things I have to do today, mm-hmm. and I have to do them. Mm-hmm. Even if it's going to cost me $125 or $180, mm-hmm. I have to do them. I've never thought about it in terms of like having to pay for it tomorrow, mm-hmm. like being less motivated or less energetic or whatever the next day. Yeah. So it's really interesting to, for someone like me who has like never even considered that or mm-hmm. thought about it,
yeah,
to now put it back and look at, okay, my day yesterday was like jam packed till mm-hmm. 9 o'clock basically. Mm-hmm. And it was exhausting. And I went home and posted two stories on Instagram about drinking a beer because that
I voted yes.
is how I relaxed. My sister was the only one who voted no at the beginning.
She was the one who said no.
Just a button.
How rude. Yeah. Yeah. And the frustrating thing for me is things cost different amounts of money every single day. So I can wake up and that shower can cost me $20 or it can cost me $2. Getting on the bike and going for a run or a bike ride around the block, that changes as well, right? So I have to look at each day as a standalone and kind of prioritize where my energy should be utilized. So do I practice self-care every day? I mean, I try to. And if I probably stayed on top of it more, that money might go a little bit farther, right? But again, like today, my priority was this podcast. So I ensured that the beginning part of my day made it so that I was the best possible that I could be this evening. So by practicing different self-care techniques, and those look different for everyone. You like to hike and get to the top of the mountain and work. Whereas I like to hike and completely turn my phone off. But it's just, it looks different for everyone and there's no right or wrong answer. It's just how you refill your cup and ensuring that you do that. So by you going for a hike in the middle of your day, maybe you're then filling yourself up to 150 for your day, right? So you're able to do a little bit more. Whereas if you didn't do that run or that hike or the workout that you do, you might not have been able to last all the way to 9 or 9:30 or whatever it was last night. Mm-hmm.
Something you mentioned the other day too was you feel like you have there's two Megans. Mm-hmm. There's healthy Megan, there's unhealthy Megan. Mm-hmm. Again, this is eye-opening for me and something that I thought about a lot afterwards because I probably have that too and maybe everyone has some variation of it.
I think so, yeah.
But the way that my head works is like if I wake up and I'm feeling exhausted or tired from the day before or whatever, in my head, I'm telling myself not to be lazy, basically.
Yeah.
I'm like,
for sure.
What do you mean you're tired? You just slept for 7 hours or what, you know, whatever. You can't be tired.
There's some negative self-talk there, but I mean.
But I think it's, I don't know. For me, mm-hmm. I look at that self-talk as positive. I look at it as pushing me to move forward.
That's true for sure. Whereas I prefer more positive language because that's what I respond better to. But if you respond to like kind of that tough love, then yeah, that's going to push you out of bed. Mm-hmm. Whereas if someone said that to me and it was a bad day, I would roll over. And that's what you're going to get from me, right? Mm-hmm. Healthy Megan is so self-aware. And I think that that stems from my schooling. I mean, anyone who's taken that program, it's literally 4 years of counseling your friends and them counseling you. Mm-hmm. So not only are you learning all these techniques, you're also learning all about yourself. Again, probably to a detriment because I overthink everything. I come out of an anxiety attack and I go, okay, well, what can I learn from that? Instead of just being patient and kind of going easy on myself. Unhealthy Megan is a bitch. she talks so negatively and it's like nothing else can be heard other than the negative self-talk and the comparisons and the you're not worthy. I can fight it as much as I want when I'm in Healthy Megan or like with through my self-care, but there's some days that physically there's nothing I can do about it. And that's where that self-compassion comes in. And for me, not calling myself lazy, not being too hard on myself when I didn't get up and have a shower and I made it from the couch to the bed, well, that's pretty good. Mm-hmm. Or I brush my teeth. I have to take those little wins and really celebrate them, knowing that what my body wants me to do versus like really what I'm capable of doing. So even on those bad days, I'm capable of more than what my brain is telling me, but I'm not as capable as Healthy Megan is. So it's kind of like that in-between gray area, right? Like something that I struggle with is black and white thinking. So everything is either good or bad, black or white. Mm-hmm. And life is not about that. Even sexuality and gender, everything is so fluid and there's a continuum. So it's living in that gray. And I really struggle with that when I'm unhealthy, because I go, I'm bad. I'm all bad. Well, that's obviously not true. There's parts of me that are good and there's parts of me that are struggling, but that doesn't mean that I'm all bad. So it's really just trying to like step out of that black and white thinking and into the gray to allow myself to be compassionate and go again to remind myself, you're not the only one going through this, because unhealthy Megan goes, you're completely alone. You're the only one to experience this. Well, again, Healthy Megan knows that that's not true, but it's just trying to talk louder than that negative voice.
Is it something that you can see right away, early in the morning?
Yes and no. So again, it's different every day.
Yeah.
I can wake up in a bad place or I can wake up in a good place. If I wake up in a good place, that doesn't mean that the whole day is going to be good. I can be triggered. I can make it through the first couple hours of the day and be like, oh my God, I misjudged this. I've already gone through my $100. And now I am empty and it's noon. So then again, being self-compassionate and going, but look at what you did before noon. Look at all these things that you did. And then when you are feeling better, or when I'm feeling better, looking back and going, okay, how can I don't want to say make up for those bad days, but how can I ensure that I'm feeling productive and that I feel like I'm contributing to make up for those days that I don't feel that I'm contributing or I don't feel quote unquote good enough. So it's just trying to like balance that out. Everything is about balance.
Is there anything that you've found that helps push you towards a better day? Like, let's say you wake up not feeling mm-hmm. very good.
Mm-hmm.
Unhealthy Megan woke up.
Mm-hmm. Go back to bed.
Yeah.
Honestly, sometimes I go back to bed and it's like, I'm going to try again in a couple of hours. I'm going to see if maybe she just needed a little bit more sleep. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. Pushing myself to go to the gym, sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes that completely empties me. So again, everything, it's different every day. And I think that's what the biggest frustration is it's completely inconsistent. So I can feel like I've gotten a hold of it and I got a good pattern and good rhythm going. And then the next day it's completely different. And it's trying to get your feet under you when you don't even know where they are.
What are you saying to yourself when you're feeling that frustration? So let's say like you had a really, are there like routines that you're trying to go through before you go to bed to eliminate or minimize the unhealthy Megan?
For sure. I mean, self-care, right? Yeah. So even in the morning, I try and eat, which seems like such a small victory. But with my depression, my appetite goes out the window. So reminding myself, even though I feel nauseous, I need to eat, because if I don't, my brain won't be fueled and it's going to be even more against me, right? Making sure I go to bed on time, which makes me a grandma. But if I'm not in bed by a certain time, again, that takes from tomorrow, especially since the way my meds work are, if I take them at a certain time, then I get to sleep for X amount of hours. So if I take them too late, well, then that moves into my morning. And it's actually like a foggy way to wake up. So trying to get to bed at a certain time, as I sit here with my monster, trying to avoid sugar, not doing very good. Avoiding alcohol, avoiding most drugs. They just counteract with my meds and it's not a good thing for me. So trying to avoid things like that, trying to avoid triggers. I mean, as much as possible, I'm not gonna. So what was the movie? 13 Reasons Why, which was about suicide. I'm not going to watch that because that's going to be triggering. Mm-hmm. So trying to not open myself up for emotions that might not be positive, might not really do anything for me. But eating properly, sleeping properly, there's this acronym called HALT, H-A-L-T. It's used in early recovery, but it's for all of us. So you need to be in control of these four things to be in control of your mood, essentially. Hunger or hydration is the H. Anger, anxiety is A. Your, what is L? Loneliness. And then T is tired. So you need to make sure that those four components of your life, so food, sleeping, the people who you surround yourself with, if you like, those are all things you can control, right? Like you can't always control your mood. You can't control the people around you. You can't control the triggers, but you can control what you're putting in your body, how much you're sleeping, that you're not completely isolating yourself. So ensuring that those things that I have in my control are being controlled.
I like that you talk about control, because mm-hmm. It's one of the things I've learned in the last few years and why I've kind of, I was always kind of not really caring as a kid about what people thought about me, but it was just less confident and certain things bugged me. But now I understand that I can't control what other people do. I have no idea what's going on behind the scenes for them.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so I know I can control what I do. And so I think that's one of the directions that have kind of pushed me towards not caring at all. And what goes through my head is, what's the alternative? If I care about someone else, I'm going to spend more time focusing on something that they want me to do rather than where I want myself to go.
Yeah.
And so just talking about control, I like that I am in complete control of who I am, the things that I do, the way I treat people.
Yeah.
Whereas when I just don't know what's going on behind the scenes for someone to say something negative to me, right?
For sure, like that. Right? And I think we talked about it before, where when someone says something to you, it says more about them than it does about you. Mm-hmm. And it's just having that mindset that you have no idea what they're going through at any given time.
Yeah.
I think about driving, and there's a situation that I think about where I was driving like a lunatic, because I needed to get somewhere. I was in full crisis mode and no one was moving fast enough. And then I go on the roads now and there's people that drive like that. And I go, well, maybe their pregnant wife is in the back seat. Maybe they're on the way because their grandma's sick. You have no idea why someone is acting that way. Mm-hmm. And again, healthy Megan likes to look at it as giving everyone the benefit of the doubt, right? So exactly like that. Well, I have no idea why that person is driving that way. Instead of, oh my God, that person's a terrible driver. What an asshole, flipping them the bird, right? So, and then by looking at it that way and the strength-based approach, it brings more positivity into my life instead of me getting agitated at something I can't control. If he's going to cut me off, I have zero control over that, right? So you can only control your response to a certain extent. I mean, some responses are pretty habitual, at least for myself, but just being in control of the way you respond to things, for sure.
You mentioned the other one of the other things that you said that I really liked the other day was everyone starts at a different position each day in terms of like emotional happiness.
Yeah.
And so you're saying, I don't know if this is like an exact number in your head or you just gave an example, but you're saying you feel like you start at minus 20 every mm-hmm. day. And just explain what that means.
So one of my diagnoses is dysthymia, which is just a perpetual depression, essentially. So if you look at the general public as their emotions, their baseline is zero. Their really good days are plus 100. Their bad days are minus 100. And there's obviously that continuum in between. With people who are living with dysthymia, their baseline might be minus 20 or less, right? So they're starting at a lower spot. So their highs might only get them to a 50 instead of to that 100. And then also their lows might take them to minus 50 instead of just minus 100. So it's just kind of being shifted into a more depressive state all the time. And again, that's just my experience with it. And that's the way it was described to me by my doctor who diagnosed me. But yeah, I mean, I think everyone to some extent, you have good days and you have bad days, right?
100%.
And I think it's just that mine are shifted down on that continuum a little bit more. And being aware of that is huge because then again, the self-compassion comes in. I can go, okay, yeah, you feel like crap today, but look at what you're working against. You're working against your own brain sometimes. And just kind of going easy on myself in those times. But sometimes I have to go hard on myself too, right? Like I have to push myself because there's times where I could stay in bed for days and that would be easy, right? We talked about during coffee, the neurological pathways in our brain. So when you have a habit or a pattern, that neurological pathway becomes like a super highway. So it's super easy to get on. You can do it without even thinking. It's just a habit. Like when you're driving from your house to work, you're like, oh my God, I got here. How did I get here? Because you were all up in your head. It's just a habit. Other pathways are like little ATV trails where you have to take a machete and your truck is getting all scratched up and there's not enough room to move. You can't just make that little trail into a super highway overnight. You have to work it. You have to take the machete to it. You have to move bigger trucks through it. You have to constantly be trying to utilize that trail instead of the super highway. So for some people, it's their super highway might be grabbing a beer because that's how they decompress at the end of the day. And if that's something you don't want to do, you have to actively try and pivot. I really liked that that Mandy was talking about pivoting versus physically changing. It's more of just a slow pivot into how you can ignite that other pathway in your brain so that that becomes your habit and that becomes second nature. Again, you're working against your brain because your brain is wired and is wiring you to act a certain way. And you have to actively try and change that and be aware of your behavior, which is so hard for some people to do, right? Like it's really, really hard to look at our own behaviors and look at how we're interacting with people and looking at how we might be affecting other people. It's a lot easier to point fingers and blame other people instead of taking some responsibility and working to change those habits.
One of the, well, the most impressive thing I found about you the other day is that You are like super self-aware. And I feel like I've made a lot of progress with that for myself in the last couple of years, but still have such a long way to go. The fact that you can pinpoint different activities in your day and understand based on how you're feeling that day, mm-hmm. how much of your $100 or 100 spoons mm-hmm. that you're taking out is a really cool thing to me.
Thank you.
And like I said, in the last couple of days, I've like been thinking about that in my own head, because awesome. I never have before.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm getting at though is it seems like you have made a lot of improvement, both in self-awareness, but in like just in how you're feeling. So going back to like how people start, I'm assuming, maybe assuming, I shouldn't assume. Knowing where to start probably is a big hurdle for some people,
mm-hmm.
or just even understanding that, yes, it can get better.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
maybe just chatting about your journey since like being diagnosed to
mm-hmm.
becoming so self-aware.
So I'm going to challenge that. Just because I'm self-aware does not mean I'm in a good place.
Sure.
So I've actually been struggling a lot lately.
But to me, self-awareness is improvement.
Yeah.
Understanding what, going from being so confused and frustrated mm-hmm. with yourself to understanding what it is that is making you exhausted or mm-hmm. frustrated or whatever.
So like I said, that changes every day. A big thing for me is meditation and checking in with my body. So I know from living with anxiety and depression for so long, where it sits in my body, how my shoulders sit, where my tension headaches start from. Is my stomach nauseous? Is it a knot? How are my hands? Are they in fists? Are they relaxed? So just kind of checking in with my body, because sometimes I'm not recognizing the thoughts until much later. Yeah, I keep missing your question, but good.
Mostly just like talking about how you've become so much
yeah.
more self-aware since you've been diagnosed, and talking about growth,
therapy. I mean, going through school was huge, because it was learning all these theories and all these techniques and all of this preventative work, and then seeing it in my life. So being able to make those correlations and really, really understand what was going on in my brain and take some of that responsibility off myself. And again, therapy. I feel like you said you have never been to counseling. I think that everyone needs to go to counseling. Hmm. Anyone. It's a third person party who has nothing to gain or lose in your life, that's able to give you a completely unbiased opinion, can give you resources, can give you new techniques that you had no idea about, right? So having someone, a professional to talk to, is huge. I'm able to bounce my ideas and bounce my self-awareness off of them and be validated when I'm saying, well, this is what I'm experiencing. Well, yeah, that's really normal.
What, to challenge that a little bit.
Oh, I like it. Let's do it.
You, like, who is validating this person? So I know there's a lot of schooling that goes into being a therapist, counselor, etc. You've recently fired one.
I fired my psychiatrist.
Psychiatrist? Okay.
Yeah.
So just because they're a doctor doesn't mean mm-hmm. they're the perfect person for 100%. you and your situation.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe just chat yeah. about your experience with
so
that.
So every doctor is different. Every style of counseling is different. Some things will work for you and some things won't. And it's really just a trial and error. And I think that is a really big barrier for some people, because they get frustrated if they go to a counselor and they're like, well, I'm not feeling it, or I don't trust this person, or that was a judgmental comment. And then they just stop. They don't go and look for anybody else. I got into that kind of hole with my psychiatrist because I had been seeing him for so long, and he had so many letters behind his name, that I just blindly trusted him. But that doesn't necessarily mean he had my best interest at heart. Again, like I said at the beginning, you know yourself better than anyone else. You have to be your biggest advocate, because the doctors are seeing so many people. And as much as they want to help you, they can sometimes be blinded by the textbooks, right? So it's really, really important to self-advocate. And if the doctor's not listening, find another doctor. Because someone will listen, because you are not alone. You're not experiencing something that no one else has experienced. So you just need to find that doctor, or find that counselor, or find that friend, and make sure it works. My last psychiatrist said some very unmoral things to me. Well, just you kind of question. You go, well, how was that helpful? He very much put a ceiling on my life, and I just accepted it. He said, don't be a mom, you'll be a great aunt. Don't coach softball, but you can be in charge of the equipment. So essentially telling me that I can't handle any responsibility. And I was like, wow, this doctor's been in school for God knows how long. He's a psychiatrist. He knows what he's talking about. So of course I shouldn't be a mom. Of course I shouldn't be doing these things. Well, and then 4 years go by and I go, this is not the quality of life that I want. There are people who try different meds. There are people who try different therapies. And this doctor wasn't even willing to change my meds or even up them. So I had to, after attempting to self-advocate with him, I had to go out and find another doctor. Again, the barrier is with mental health and mental illness, there are very, especially on the island where I live, there are very few resources. And those resources usually have a really long wait list. So to put myself in a potentially risky situation and take that time to switch doctors and then get back onto a wait list could have gone really bad. But my fear of staying with that psychiatrist would have been way worse, because he would have continuously pushed me down. I would have tried to get better. He would have pushed me down. So my new psychiatrist, so far, so good. She's amazing. But I've come to the realization that if they're not going to put it all in for me, like, I've got to do that for myself.
Back to self-awareness, right?
Exactly. 100%.
In the last couple of years, I've gone through, I'd say, one big T and a bunch of small T's.
Yeah.
And I found a lot of therapy and fitness. Mm-hmm. And I didn't run or work out for like 3 years and was terribly out of shape, and found that that was a really good way to clear my head.
Endorphins.
Totally. Yeah. I wasn't really ready to talk about it yet, but now I do. And it's mostly with like friends and family, but now I'm pretty open and I'll just say anything to anyone.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But at the beginning, I don't know. I've you mentioned me never trying counseling or therapy. Mm-hmm. And I think I'd be open to it.
Yeah.
I just have figured out some therapeutic things that work for me.
Well, yeah. And I think in the conversation with Mandy, you talked about this being your therapy, podcasting being your therapy. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I mean, everyone's therapy looks different. Sitting in a car at 3 o'clock in the morning in the rain with your music blaring and your best friend sitting beside you, that can be therapy, right? Going for a bike ride by yourself, that can be therapy. But having that third person sometimes is a little bit better, because we can get stuck in our own heads and make up these stories.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The reason that personally I was hesitant about it is because that third person has zero context. Whereas like a best friend or a brother or something like that is seeing it happen as it happens.
They're seeing what you want them to see though, aren't they? Unless they're sitting right beside you through it all.
Yeah, one person did.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough.
So to me, it was that. It was that.
That person?
It was that, I don't know, that person saw the whole situation rather than being told the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was it for me, is the context thing. And that's where it goes back to like not judging people. And that was one of my goals for 2019, is to never judge, be empathetic. Mm-hmm. And it goes to context. I have no context about what is going on with Carl behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
I see
him just playing with his beard. That's all he's doing.
And we play basketball together once a year in the STL alumni tournament, which is in the week
he's
from now.
He's hanging out, drinking $15 wine. That's all he's doing.
But I guess that can be overcome if you put in the time, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I question that specific person in your life did see both sides, that person may have seen both sides through your perspective. So knowing what that big T is, there's other people involved in it. So it might look different from someone else's perspective, right?
Sure.
We all come into every event with this lens that we've created based on our lived experiences, based on how we were raised, based on our religion, if there is one, based on genetics, based on like all of these things, nature versus nurture, correct? Mm-hmm. So it's really hard to see things through other people's lenses because we have no idea what they've experienced. And that's, I think, where therapy comes in really good, because you give the context and it's that person, the therapist, will help you through your perspective. And that's really all that matters in that situation. I mean, ideally, you would look at things through the other individual's perspective as well. But to deal with your own emotions and to heal in a way, it's really good to know your perspective and know your lens and then heal through it. And then when you're healthier and healed, you're able to look through other people's perspectives and lenses a little bit better, because it's not as clouded with your own stuff.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about your big T?
Do you want me to?
Let's do some therapy.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, tell me about it.
What do you want me to say?
So you are going through a divorce.
Correct.
Correct. That's a big, big trauma. That's huge. I know it. Well, I don't know because I've never been divorced or married, but I would imagine that a lot of blame or guilt can come into that. Both ways, a lot of finger pointing. How do you think you've dealt with that? Like, do you tend to...
With the blame part?
Yeah. Yeah. Do you find that you're taking on the blame? Do you find that you're putting blame on your ex? How is that all kind of balancing out for you?
I think I probably take... that's a good question. I don't know. I think it goes both ways.
For sure.
I think...
takes two to tango, right?
I think there's things that I could have done better. I feel mm-hmm. like I prepared the situation for who I wanted to be in my life, and it mm-hmm. didn't work out. Mm-hmm. I understand that she needs and wants more from this type of relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like I can understand.
So how, is there anything that you've done to like not take it to heart? And like, because I've been cheated on and I know that there's so much mistrust that comes from that just with that person. And then that kind of flows into other relationships in your life. Have you found that you're like anxious to get back out there, or you're kind of questioning other people's motives a little bit more?
Yes to both.
Yes to both.
In terms of the trusting, I think it's always in the back of my head now.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm fairly good at isolating it towards that situation.
Yeah.
And understanding that every human is different
mm-hmm.
and every human will make different decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's always going to be there.
For sure.
I don't know. I just feel like I've done a fairly good job for me in being able to step back outside the situation and understanding that it's an isolated situation. It's not a world thing. It's not that this is necessarily going to happen again. It was mm-hmm. in this situation.
Where do you think that comes from? Because so your parents are still together. So you were raised in like a traditionally normal nuclear family.
Mm-hmm.
So how has that kind of overflowed into your divorce? Is there kind of shame and guilt coming from that because it didn't work out? Or is there like kind of generational stuff that's coming down from like your parents who have been able to fight and stay together? And yeah.
I think initially there was some embarrassment, but now,
mm-hmm.
now it's just like, it is what it is. And
yeah.
I look at it as a great learning experience. Mm-hmm. I feel like it has pushed me to become who I like more who I am. Mm-hmm. I felt like there was maybe similar with your therapy situation. I felt like there was a ceiling.
Yeah.
And I felt like I was capped because I was being pressured every day to be someone who mm-hmm. I wasn't really ready to give up the ambition and the passion for the career,
mm-hmm.
which I would have had to take a step back from to make it better.
Yeah.
I don't even know if it would have worked, but to make it better at the time. So I don't know. I have no idea what my family thinks.
You haven't asked them or had any conversations with them about it.
Well, they're super supportive, but I don't know what they say behind my back. I would assume they're supportive. I don't know. But like being from a very conservative religious family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would assume that it's embarrassing for them too. But I don't really care.
Good for you.
I always talk about like light. For whatever reason, I picked this number. I don't know why. I have 113 years to live.
That's a very specific number.
Correct. And
all right.
If I worry about being embarrassed for a long period of time, mm-hmm. if I dwell too much on what could have changed, I'm just wasting the very short period of time that I have.
Well, 113 years, that's not very short, but...
I have 83 years left.
Oh, okay. That's...
That's not very long.
I guess, you're right. That's not very long.
I don't know. I just...
It seems like a very long time to me. Maybe I just never saw I never saw myself as an old person.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Like, I never... People go, oh, I see myself, like, in a rocking chair on a patio. And I'm like, I really never... like imagine myself as an old person. I don't know if that's like the depression talking and like that I wouldn't make it to that point, but mm-hmm. it's just never been anything I've thought about, which is, it's cool to hear other people have plans for the next 83 years.
I just like,
life.
There's so many things that I want to accomplish
mm-hmm.
and I feel like I just don't have much time to mm-hmm. dwell too much on it.
Yeah, you said something, I believe it was with Danielle, where it's, is this going to matter in 5 minutes? Is this going to matter in 5 days? Is this going to matter in a year?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just being aware of that, right? So if something is going to matter in a year, how do you process it? If something's not going to matter in 5 minutes, you still have to process those emotions. You can't mm-hmm. just ignore them, but the processing looks very different, right? So this, like your divorce... is going to matter for a little while, even though you feel like you've healed and you feel like you're kind of have closure on it. The legal aspect lasts for a little bit longer. And then depending on how the split goes, it can continue whether you want it to or not. Right. Same with some of those traumas. Even the little traumas can kind of poke their head up when you don't expect it.
I don't expect it to ever go away. I think it'll be with me forever.
Yeah.
I just think it'll get to a point where it's minimalized and then it just stays there for the like forever.
Yeah.
Certain things that go on in your life may trigger a photo in your head or like mm-hmm. some remembrance of some small situation.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, I just feel like there's too much I want to do mm-hmm. to dwell on it. It's like, it's... it's funny. I told my friend like the day that I found out that this was going to be the best thing that's ever happened to me. And so
perspective, right?
Yeah. It's cool to now be a year away from that mm-hmm. and just see how much I've grown in 12 months.
Yeah. That's
awesome.
Insane. That's again, great self-awareness, right? And seeing where you've come and seeing mm-hmm. where you want to go. I think another thing is you're saying that the divorce will stick with you for a really long time. And I think that those kind of memories will turn maybe into like a positive, right? You'll focus less on what happened and that you were able to experience that, if that makes sense. Like, I mean, you obviously think like that more than I do.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of looking back at more fondly than maybe you are right now. The farther you get away from things, right?
Agree. I think it's pushed me in a very good direction.
Mm-hmm.
And so long term, I think both of us will be way better off for it.
I think that says a lot about you to just have mentioned that right now, that it, that both of you are going to benefit from it, right?
I think so.
Took two to tango, so both people have to heal and move on as well.
Like, and you're, I don't know, I tend to think more about the positive,
mm-hmm.
or take the positives out of a situation. Mm-hmm. And there was like, we're together for a long time.
Yeah.
There was a lot of good things that happened.
Yeah.
Is a negative going to overrule all the experiences? No.
Mm-hmm.
But it, like that loss in the U17 national championship, that's the thing that you remember the most.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Even just like the, I spent 3 days crying on the floor in my condo. And what was going through my head is so strange. Like, I don't know why this stuff goes through my head, but
mm-hmm.
it was the same as the basketball game.
Yeah.
It was, I want to remember how painful this is so I never put myself in this situation again.
Interesting. Interesting. So it's, you're motivated by fear of feeling that again? Or a fear of avoiding that feeling?
I think I say learning experience just because there was signs that I ignored. The next time I won't ignore them.
That's fair. Yeah, for sure. And learning what to look for and learning, but also like learning what you want out of a relationship and what your needs are and the type of person who's going to be able to meet those needs. And not holding it against someone who can't. I was told once, you don't go to a shoe store looking to buy milk and then get mad that they don't have milk.
Yeah.
Some people just can't meet the needs that you want. That doesn't mean that they can't be in your life. You just can't ask them for something that they can't give you. Right? So some people are able to support you and sit in that darkness with you, and other people, it's very uncomfortable for them. So you just, you don't go to them for that. Right?
Let's talk about support.
Cuckoo, yeah.
Away from me and my situation. We talked a little bit the other day about signs in terms of being friends with someone who is maybe struggling.
Mm. Yeah, for
what
sure.
What to look for, how to help. And I was listening to that podcast today.
Armchair Expert.
Lena Dunham.
Yeah, with Dax Shepard.
One thing she said is, people get frustrated when they try to help and the help is turned away.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing you have to understand is that you need to show up for the people in the way that they want you to show up.
For sure.
Not the way that you would want them to show up for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So everyone, kind of like love languages, right? Like everyone shows love in a different way. Everyone shows support in a different way. Everyone needs different support depending on what they're going through, depending on, again, their lived experiences. Maybe physical touch might be very uncomfortable for someone, whereas someone else might really be comforted by like a big hug or some cuddling. So it's really just communicating with that person and blatantly asking, like, what do you need in this moment? What can I do in this moment to help you? And that was something we learned in Zambia, was you don't know what that person is going through and you can't make a decision for them. So you can't decide that this person needs therapy. You can't decide that for anybody. Again, we're only in control of ourselves. You can for sure offer resources, share your concern, talk to them, tell them that you're there. But you can't force anything on them. It's really important to meet that person where they're at. So we talked about if your friend is constantly bailing on parties, well, maybe you go and sit with them instead of going to a party. Maybe it's the social interaction of that too many people that's making that person too anxious to go out. You need to, sometimes trying to make light of the situation, which I enjoy doing, goofing off and laughing, that can be very, very healing. But also it can be very ostracizing because that person might not have quote unquote happiness or laughter in them right now. So to just sit in the darkness with them might make you feel uncomfortable, but it's going to make them feel so cared about because they feel like they're alone, right? Like that's one of the things that mental illness tells us is you're alone. And I mean, that's so not true. Being patient is so important as well. Not shaming, not guilting, being like, oh, you bailed on us last time. Like, what's wrong with you? That's not going to help. That's going to ostracize them and they're going to stop responding, most likely. Something that I really benefit from is continuously people inviting me out. Even if I do say no, invite me out next time. Even if I say no again, keep inviting me out, because that means you're thinking about me. You're not holding it against me if I'm not strong enough to go out that day. And you're saying that you still care about me and still want to spend time with me.
Mm-hmm.
There's this analogy of Eeyore in Winnie the Pooh. And it's, he is depression, right? You look at him and he's depressed all the time. He's moping, he's woe is me. Winnie the Pooh and all of his friends still go check on him, still go hang out with him. They don't expect him to be anything but Eeyore, but they still want to spend time with him because they care about him as he is. They're not asking him to be anything else, right? Like some people who are depressed are in that mood for a really long time, in that darkness for a really long time. That doesn't mean that they need to be alone that whole time either. I think it's really important for people who think they're experiencing mental illness, as well as like their friends, to do some research online. There's some great resources out there. The Canadian Mental Health Association has some really great resources for both sides, even for parents, for teachers. They have these fact sheets that are concise and things to look for. Super, super helpful, as well as like being able to utilize language if that person is in that space. It's important to watch the language we're using. It's important to be compassionate, to avoid the tough love that doesn't work 99% of the time,
yeah.
Right? Like giving people ultimatums, like either you come out or we're not friends anymore. Well, that's not going to make them feel loved or cared about, right? It's going to completely stigmatize the way that they're feeling. So you want to reduce the stigma as much as possible. Even if you don't understand, and just like you said at the beginning of the podcast, like, I might be very ignorant about this. Please tell me. Like, tell me your experience. Tell me what you're thinking. Tell me your thought process, right? So just being aware that it's different for everybody. It looks different for everybody. But that you can still be supportive and sit with that person in it.
Something you said the other day was be more specific
mm-hmm.
in how you're asking.
Ask
don't,
the tough questions.
Just say, are you feeling okay today?
Yeah. How are you feeling?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Because that pisses you off.
Oh, it does. It does. Like, stop asking me how I'm doing. Yeah. There's some really hard questions that sometimes need to be asked. If you're concerned about a friend or a loved one's safety, blatantly ask. Don't beat around the bush and go, how are you feeling? Have you done anything that you regret? No. Are you currently suicidal? Do you have a plan to kill yourself? Do you have the means to kill yourself? If your plan is, God forbid, to hang yourself, but you don't have anywhere to hang yourself, well, then that's not a very thorough plan, right? So it's just different levels of risk. So being able to blatantly ask, have you thought about killing yourself today? That's a really awkward question. But what's even more awkward is not having that person across from you anymore, but because they have committed suicide. By asking those tough questions, you're reducing the stigma again, because you're not being scared of that language. You're not shying away from that answer that you might get. It might not be the answer that you want, but at least you're giving them that space to talk about it. And now that it is out in the open, you guys can both kind of go to the next step, go to a doctor, go whatever, right? Go to the hospital if it is an emergency. Mm-hmm.
It's, I think it's hard to notice them correctly,
the
or like pinpoint signs correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Often, just from my experience, it feels like they're, if someone ditches on something, mm-hmm. it feels like they're disrespecting you.
That's
rather
fair.
Than mm-hmm. understanding that, again, like in anything, if someone if someone says something negative towards you, it's likely nothing to do with you. Mm-hmm. It's likely to do with something 100%. Going on in their head.
Yeah.
So I think it's just being able to pull yourself out of the situation and see it bigger picture, mm-hmm. understanding that because someone is missing this party or because they mm-hmm. don't want to go for lunch anymore,
yeah.
it's likely something going on in their head. It has nothing
for
to do
sure.
with you.
For sure, right? And then that goes be patient. I don't know how many times where I've fully gotten ready, cried the whole way through it, and I'm like, nope, I'm doing this, I'm getting ready, makeup is running down my face, I'm supposed to be there in 5 minutes, and I go, I cannot leave the house. I have tried, I have used all 100 spoons to get ready because I really wanted to go, and I physically cannot do it. And that sucks. I feel crappy. I feel like I've let down my friends or my loved ones. And to just like try not to perpetuate that feeling, I mean, I haven't been on the other side of it very much, so I can't imagine what it feels like, but to try not to take it personally, mm-hmm. to try and remember. So my uncle once told me, I lived in Comox, beautiful place, anywhere on the island, gorgeous. You live on the ocean, right? Like, you can't complain. And my uncle said to me, you live on a beach. Deer are your neighbors. Like, what do you have to be depressed about? And I go, you could put me in Bora Bora on the most gorgeous beach with all my loved ones, and I could still be depressed. And there is nothing that can change that. So it's internal versus external, right? Like a lot of my mental, again, my experience, not everyone's, my mental illness comes from internal. I create these stories and I ruminate and they just snowball. So it has nothing to do with external. I mean, of course, sometimes seeing my best friend definitely makes a difference, or hugging my puppy, of course, makes me feel better. That doesn't take the depression away. Right? So it's just, yeah, it's again, balance, right? But you have to try not to take it personally, because they already feel like crap for letting you down, at least in my perspective. So say I got all ready and I didn't go to that birthday party. Well, the story I'm saying is I'm a shitty friend. I'm unworthy. I'm unreliable. I'm flaky. Why are people friends with me? I have nothing to offer them. I can't even get my shit together and get out the door. Why would someone want to spend time with me? Ongoing. Deeper and deeper into that negative self-talk, right? And that doesn't help. But nothing external is going to change that. I have to stop what I'm doing, meditate, look at my body physically, where is this coming from? And challenge those thoughts and go, just because I'm thinking it doesn't mean it's real, right? Just because I'm having that thought doesn't make it a fact. And again, that's easier said than done a lot of the times, because your brain is going, well, no, it is fact. No, this is what they're saying behind your back because you didn't go to the party.
Yeah.
And then it can really, really snowball. But trying to like catch it beforehand, at least for me, is helpful. And that just because you think it doesn't make it true. Learn that in therapy too, right? So it's just trying to, I guess, control or like understand as much as you can in that moment. And again, compassion for your friends, for yourself. Go easy on yourself. Everyone's fighting a battle that you know nothing about. Nothing. There's this organization called Challenge Day, and they do these amazing workshops with youth about like how to recognize yourself and know yourself and like to prevent bullying. And that's where I learned like the Be a Man box and and all of that stuff. It's an amazing organization. Oh my goodness. Yeah, but you should definitely go to Challenge Day. I've learned so much.
We have Challenge Day.
Yeah.
The last thing I wanted to touch on, and as we're going through this mm-hmm. has been in the back of my head. It's more, for me, I'm just so curious of mm. like where does mental health stem from? Where does mm. depression come from? And we talked a little bit about mm-hmm. it. Like, is it a nature thing? Is it something that is biological mm-hmm. or is it a nurture thing? And is it something that is maybe expanded as you go through life with some really traumatic or negative experiences?
Yeah, I think just like everything in life, it's nature and nurture, right? There's, I mean, there's definitely, like I said, those big traumas, 100% is nurture, right? That's the way that you're experiencing life.
Sure. But the way that you maybe are perceiving those mm-hmm. big traumas is to do with, or well, to do with your genetic makeup, to do with your
but
brain.
Also the way that you were raised.
Right.
Right. So if you were raised to push down your feelings and not feel them, then that's how you're going to respond.
Sure.
If you, when you cry and your parents told you, don't cry, man up, then that's how you're going to continue to learn, right? Your attachment in the first few years of your life is a model and mirrors the attachment for the rest of your life. So those early years of nurturing 100% will affect your mental health and your mental illnesses throughout time. But it also, excuse me, like you said, affects how you respond to things and affects how you look at things. So if you were raised to look through a religious model, then that is going to 100% change or pivot the way that you look at your mental health. And maybe you'd, I'm not going to speak on any religion. Stay away from that one. But seriously, right? Like there's, if your parents were divorced, that's definitely going to change the way that you respond to things. If, you were raised in an abusive relationship or experienced a lot of trauma in the first few years of your life, that changes the way that your brain is actually structured. So again, those little cuts in your brain at a younger age take up more of your brain space and they physically rewire your brain. So if you look at like a mind when they, I think it's a CAT scan when you scan your mind or an MRI, one of those.
CAT scan.
Thank you. Yeah. I had an MRI on my knee, so that's clearly not it. So a CAT scan, you look at it and it lights up like a map. So there's all these dots with the lines that attach and it looks like this crazy web. So that is all like your experiences and the neurological pathways, like we talked about, the superhighways. And then over in the corner, not connected to the rest of the map, there's this little mini map, and that's your trauma. And it's held in a different part of your brain, and it's completely separate from the rest of your thought process. So through this, I'm doing a new type of therapy right now called eye movement desensitization and restructuring. So it's physically connecting that little trauma map to the rest of your brain so that your cortex, the part of your brain that's emotion and consequences, is able to fully work through the trauma, which is in your amygdala. So it connects those two parts of your brain and you're able to better process it. If that makes sense.
Sounds like science.
It makes sense. Right? But it just, it, and for me, knowing those things about science just kind of like takes some of the onus off of me, right? Like I have been very hard on myself being like, this is your fault. You're not strong enough. Like, come on, get over this. You're supposed to be a counselor. What the hell are you doing? It's like, well, I picked the short straw. Literally nothing I could do about it. My brain, because of the way my family is, there is some predisposed neurological pathways for addiction, for mental health, etc. And then because of those traumas, it just created the perfect storm. So not everyone has both and, but some people do. Some people, their trauma is the way that they were raised, and that's a whole other animal, right? And I would imagine that that's harder to kind of get out of because you're relearning so many different things about yourself as well as the world around you. I feel like I'm rambling.
No, that was really good. That was really good. Okay, I think we should probably wrap up. It's getting late.
Is it really?
Thank you.
Cool.
Thanks so much for coming on. Thank you for being so open and
for sure
honest and pushing me to be probably the most vulnerable I've been on the podcast.
That's awesome. Good for you.
It wasn't that bad.
Way to be brave. No, not at all.
Podcasts are fun.
Yeah, podcasts are fun.
It's just conversation. That's why I
love them so much. Have some intense stress sweat right now. But it's okay.
Good thing no one's watching.
Yeah. There you go.
As you've listened to many of the Zero to Hero podcasts, you know that you get to make the final statement.
I do, for sure.
Do you have something prepared?
I do. So just before that, I want to throw out some recommendations like, again, if you're living with or supporting somebody, or just want to know more so that you're more educated on it. Brené Brown is one of my favorite authors. She is phenomenal. She talks about vulnerability. She talks about, like, sitting in the awkwardness and the uncomfortableness and how to grow from it. So that's, like, very up your alley. The gifts of imperfection. So for myself, I am a perfectionist. And that takes a lot away from me because I focus and I get, like, tunnel vision. So she talks about how to learn from your imperfections and how being imperfect is actually a strength, which is really cool. Matt Haig is also an author. He has an amazing social media. It's very positive. There's a lot of really amazing quotes, a lot of resources. He's written some great books. He just wrote this book for children and youth called The Truth Pixie, and it's about living with anxiety and depression as a young kid. So it really, like, normalizes those feelings.
Yeah. I followed him today. I think his Instagram is Matt Z Haig.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah, there's some great stuff on there. He also does, similar to you, like, the stories, and kind of says a few things here and there, which are awesome. Like I said, the Canadian Mental Health Association, great resource for anybody, personal, professional, anybody. Movember.org is great for men. There's some really great resources on there that are specifically for men. Again, because they're such a higher rate of suicide and a lower rate of looking for assistance, mm-hmm. it's kind of a special little niche over there for them. And finally, Bell Let's Talk, which is amazing. And that Bell Let's Talk Day is on January 30th this year.
It's coming up. Yeah.
It is, yeah. So what they're doing, I mean, they've done a million times and raised so much money. Every text message, if you're on a Bell account, as well as every tweet, every Instagram post, every Facebook post, every everything on social media, they count all of those up and they donate money to mental health associations within Canada. So it's a great way to give back. If you have money, amazing. If not, you can still spread the good word, I guess, reduce stigma by just talking about it. So that's an amazing organization at the end of the month as well. But yeah, so I think the last word is just kind of like we talked about, you never know what someone is going through. So just be self-compassionate as well as compassionate to other people. Being patient with yourself is amazing. So one of Matt Haig's quotes is one of my favorite. It's actually my background on my phone right now. It's mental health problems do not define you. They are something that you experience. You walk in the rain and you feel the rain, but importantly, you are not the rain. Does that make sense?
Totally. That's really cool.
It gives me goosebumps. I love that quote. It just, again, it externalizes it, right? It takes that kind of, like, blame off of you. And it's totally fine to feel the rain and experience it, but to remove it. So it's, again, language. I am not depressed. I live with depression. So taking those labels and taking them off of me, because me as a whole, I'm not just depressed. I'm a sister. I'm a cousin. I'm hysterical to the right people, but I'm so much more, right? So just looking at it as a part of you instead of all of you, because you have more to offer.
100%. Even looking back at my experience, I've never obviously put it into such really nice words.
Me neither.
But I look at my situations and just be like, I am who I am. Mm-hmm. Nothing I did specifically caused it.
Oh.
It just didn't work out and you move on.
Yeah, exactly, right? I mean, there's obviously things that we can do to magnify situations, and there's also things we can do to mitigate them. But in a whole, you can't control what is going on. Especially, and that's a thing for me, is I feel so out of control a lot of the time with my emotions that I try and gain control wherever I can. So one of my anxieties is not arriving on time. So I was here super early, sitting in the back, listening to my music, because I can control that. I can't control the traffic in New West, but I can control that I leave early enough that no matter what is going on in the traffic, I am still on time. Because I would hate to feel like I left you guys waiting. And then that whole story creates, right?
I totally share that anxiety too.
Yeah.
If I'm sitting in traffic, and a lot of it's for work for me, so it is
for sure
of ultra importance that I'm there on time. Yeah. And I most of the time give myself enough time. But if I'm like flirting with a deadline and I'm sitting in traffic, I can feel my heart like start racing. I'm super anxious. And I guess a lot of people might battle that, but I just wanted to mention, like, that is something that I deal with all the time.
Yeah. So knowing that, you control what you can control, right? So that's amazing self-awareness as well.
Like, I set all my watches to like 7 minutes faster than the real time.
There you go. Well, yeah, I don't do that. I just show up everywhere 45 minutes early.
That's fair. That's the other option too.
Yeah.
Megan, thanks again so much for coming on.
Thank you, Danny and Carl.
If people have questions about mental health, can they shoot you an Instagram message?
For sure. So my Instagram is private, but you can definitely DM me or Facebook me. That's totally fine. I don't live in the Lower Mainland anymore, but I am blessed to know some amazing youth workers and counselors and social workers here. From my time working here, I have literally a binder. Again, my OCD. A binder. I'm not joking when I say a binder. And it's all organized of all these different resources, free, that you have to pay for, that are for specifically mental health, specifically addictions, comorbid, like all of these different things. And they're so underutilized because I think not a lot of people know about them. And even doctors don't know about them. So again, like doing your own research and going into your doctor and saying, I want a referral to this program, is super helpful because that doctor might not know that program.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm always up for a conversation. Like I said, super vulnerable. So would love to shoot the shit and bounce things off of other people. And yeah, I'm around.
Totally. Okay. Thanks again so much for coming
on. Thank you.
Guys, have a good evening. Thanks for listening. Hit me up on Instagram if you have any feedback. I'd love to hear it. Danny.Duma. Hey, yeah.